Well, I am quite excited to be preaching through the book of Esther over the next few weeks. And I'm quite excited because it's one of my favourite Bible books. Now, at one level, that's not surprising. Ask me to preach through a book of the Bible and it'll probably become my favourite. But Esther has always been one of my favourites. I love Esther partly because it's such a page-turner. It's a cracking read. I love books that are so full of suspense, you can't put them down. A couple of years ago, my wife Hannah couldn't sleep. And so I said, well, I'll read to you, send you to sleep. And trouble was, it worked really well, but the book I was reading was the teenage spy novel Alex Rider. If you know the book, you'll know what my kind of mental age is. And every chapter left us on such a knife edge that Hannah was wide awake for the next 2 hours until we finished the book. It was a good book. The book of Esther is more of a page-turner than that. It comes with a health warning. Okay, if you're trying to get asleep at night, probably don't read the book of Esther. There's, read Esther when you want to be wide awake. But the main reason I love the book of Esther is because it feels so real, it feels so relevant, it rings true, it could almost be today. First tonight we're going to explore the human geography of the book of Esther, and then we're going to throw open the shutters and see God at work behind the scene. First thing we see then tonight is this, that the world is dreadful. The world is dreadful. We see the world is dreadful in the excess of the king. Have a look at verse 1 with me of the first chapter again, please. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. Xerxes, what a king he was. What a name, what a king, Xerxes. He ruled the whole Persian Empire from India in the east, all the way over to Sudan in the west, that's Kush. His kingdom straddled as many time zones as Africa does today. Now, perhaps some of you have travelled to trade fairs. Perhaps you've even shown off some of your company's latest products in trade fairs. Well, here in the opening verses, King Xerxes holds a fair to show off all the wealth of his empire, all the power, all the resources, all the culture. And his trade fair lasts for 6 months. And verse 5 says, at the end, he held a feast. And this banquet, it was a bit like an Indian wedding because it lasted a whole week. Except he chose to invite every single resident of his capital, perhaps his winter capital, Susa. Now, what would we have seen if we'd been there? Let's have a look. Have a look at verse 6 with me again, please. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other, and the royal wine was abundant, in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. What a palace! This palace gets a better write-up than nearly any other building in the Bible. Can you imagine those marble pillars, the linen hangings, the extraordinary mosaic pavements with those solid gold or silver couches on there. What a palace. And see the excess of the king. Which champagne would you like? Bollinger, a Dom Perignon, a Veuve Clicquot, it's up to you. He would have said, can we sense the excess of the king? And isn't it a bit scary? Such power in the hands of one man. He ruled one of the two superpowers of the time, not Greece but Persia. He had cash to burn, and he did. And imagine if all that wealth and power and resources were funneled against God's people. Imagine if that were to happen. A bit like today, imagine like America, all the power of America. Imagine if that were funneled against Christians. It'd be scary, wouldn't it? The excess of the king suggests hints that the world is dreadful. Now, I don't mean that it's wrong to throw a feast. Thank God for fine food and architecture. But that's the trouble, isn't it? We don't see Xerxes giving thanks to God for his feast. And then what an awful show of drunkenness. Verse 10 says that on the seventh day, King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine. Well, after 7 days, I guess that's an understatement. Today, as Christians, we sit in the shadow of secular excess, don't we? Let's be encouraged that God's word is relevant in a place of dreadful excess. God has something to say in a society where people spend excessive amounts of money, where people consume food and drink to excess. The Book of Esther, the Bible, is relevant in a world where individuals have excessive power. Yes, the world is dreadful. And we see that not just in the excess of the king, but also in the expulsion of the queen. The expulsion of the queen. Come to verse 10 with me, would you? On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the seven eunuchs who served him, Mehuman, Biztha, Harbonah, Bigtha, Abagatha, Zethar, and Carcass, to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king was furious and burned with anger. Xerxes wants to show off his wife. He might have had a number of wives, but perhaps she was his most beautiful, Queen Vashti. He commands his wife to perform for his drunken guests, his companions. And she refuses, rightly or wrongly. Xerxes risks embarrassment that could be politically disastrous. And he consults his advisors. And the advice comes in verse 16 to 21. Expel the queen and send messengers. Send messengers throughout the vast empire in every language of the 127 provinces to tell of the queen's offense, to tell of the king's punishment, and let that be a lesson to all the rebellious women out there in the realm. So they said. Well, what are we to make of the expulsion of the queen? It's easy to moralize in a book like Esther, isn't it? To think that Esther is here to teach us how to behave, good behavior and bad behavior. But on what basis do we moralize? See, the author makes no moral judgment anywhere in the book. There's no explicit indication anywhere of who's right and who's wrong. Explicitly. Now clearly the Bible does teach that wives are to submit to their husbands. It's controversial, but there it is in Ephesians chapter 5. But in the same passage it tells husbands to love their wives as much as Christ loved the church. And he died for the church. And so I take it a husband is never to harshly demand obedience from his wife or to force her to submit. So what are we to make of the expulsion of Queen Xerxes, Queen Vashti? Well, I guess that this is the real world. You don't need me to tell you that relationships between men and women are in trouble in our country. I guess most women are feminist. I guess many men are male chauvinists in practice, at least. And could we say that results in a dreadful conflict in many relationships? Well, let's be encouraged that God's word is relevant in our society. It's relevant in a society where divorce is almost the norm. God has something to say to people who feel the pain of broken relationships. The book of Esther the Bible, it is relevant in a world where men and women fight. The expulsion of the queen must have been scary for many people. Verse 19 says, the king's decree cannot be repealed. Well, again, what if such a decree that cannot be repealed were turned against God's people? A scary world. What then? It is a dreadful world. Well, we see that not just in the excess of the king and the expulsion of the queen, but also in the exploitation of the virgins. The exploitation of the virgins. Look with me, please, to chapter 2, verse 1. Chapter 2, verse 1. Later, when the anger of King Xerxes had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done, and what he had decreed about her. Then the king's personal attendants proposed, let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful girls into the harem at the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the girl who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, son of Kish. Let's keep going. Who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. Among those taken captive with Jehoiakim, king of Judah. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This girl, who was also known as Esther, was lovely in form and features, and Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and her mother had died. When the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many girls were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Hegai. Esther also was taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Hegai, who had charge of the harem. We flick on to verse 12. Verse 12, before a girl's turn came to go into King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 with perfumes and cosmetics. And this is how she would go to the king. Anything she wanted was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go there, and in the morning return to another part of the harem to the care of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the concubines. She would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and summoned her by name. There's a lot of detail there, which we can't go into for the sake of time. But can you see the exploitation of the virgins? We're not told if they were forced to enter the harem or if they went of their own free will. Verse 8 simply says they were brought to the citadel, to the palace. After a year of beauty treatments, can you imagine what they would look like after that? Each woman had one night with a king, a doll for him to play with exactly as he pleased. And the one who pleased him best would be his wife. She would have no choice in the matter. What about the rest? I guess they would see out their lonely lives in the harem entirely at his beck and call. And maybe some here understand through personal experience something of the abuse those women suffered. All I know is the world is dreadful. Let's not be in love with this world. Let's not think this world is morally neutral. Let's be wary of this world. Let's not depend on this world for our security. But before we apply this very practically, I'd like us to see that there's a second point in these chapters. If first the world is dreadful, well, secondly, God is active. God is active. And maybe you think that's a surprising point to make from these chapters. After all, God isn't mentioned, is he? In fact, and many of you will know that Esther is the one book of the Bible, with the possible exception of the Song of Songs, which never mentions God at all. In fact, there's no mention of anything religious in Esther. No mention of temple or priests, not a single miracle, no one prophesies, no one even prays. in the book of Esther. And if Esther's people were not Jews, there'd be virtually nothing to link this book with the rest of the Bible. So why is our second point that God is active? Well, let me ask another question. Where is God in the book of Esther? In many books of the Bible, God is somewhere, isn't he? In many books of the Bible, God's there in the temple, or in the priests, or in the miracles, or in the prophecy, or something like that. Perhaps God's like a fire engine, and mainly hidden, except for in emergencies. But not in the book of Esther. You won't find him somewhere in any sacred or religious purple passage. Well, if God isn't somewhere, then perhaps he's nowhere. Perhaps this is just a secular document. Perhaps has nothing to do with God. I guess the atheists would tell us that these events are just nothing but chance and circumstance. And yet, how many atheists reveal their inconsistent superstition by touching wood or quoting Sod's Law? And yet, we can't say that God is nowhere in the book of Esther because Esther's part of the Bible. And Jesus said in Luke chapter 24, he taught briefly, I suppose, through all the scriptures, it says, and he pointed out how all the scriptures had to say about himself. So God can't be nowhere in the book of Esther. Well, as a previous pastor once showed me, if God isn't somewhere, and he isn't nowhere, then where could he be? There's only one option left. He must be everywhere. In other words, God is active. He's active in every single part of this account. See, God is active despite the fact that the world is dreadful. More than that, God is active even through those dreadful things of the world. Think about the chain of events that's going on here. The excess of the king, his wealth, his power, his opulent party, his drunkenness that led him to call for Vashti to come and perform. What if that hadn't happened? Well, there'd have been no reason for the queen to refuse him. Think about the expulsion of the queen. What if she hadn't disobeyed the king? Or what if he had taken pity on her and she hadn't been expelled? Then there'd have been no search for a new queen. Think of the exploitation of the virgins. What if that hadn't happened? What if the king had been content with one fewer wife? What if he'd followed custom by marrying a member of the select nobility? Then Esther would never have become queen. Over the coming weeks, we're going to see Esther saving her people from genocide. That's going to be the big thing. Then what if she'd kept quiet? What if she'd never become queen? Or she wouldn't have been able to save her people. See, God was active at every stage of that long and complicated chain of events, in the little things and the big things, to pursue his purpose. Does that mean he was responsible for those dreadful things that happened? No, the Bible is clear that we humans make real choices. And I guess we know in our experience that we're making, that we're responsible for those choices as we make them. And if we congratulate each other for good actions, so too we tell each other off for wrong actions too. And yet in God's ultimate wisdom and power, he is in control and working his purposes out. Remember how Joseph's brother sold him into slavery in Egypt. And many years later, Joseph spoke to those same brothers and he said to them, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, for the saving of many lives." God is active. It's the doctrine of providence, if you want the technical term. And it's incredibly comforting for Christians. That God is not the blind watchmaker who's wound up the world and left it to go like some toy. He's continually involved with all created things. He makes sure the speed of light is constant every moment. He cooperates with a grain of wheat to make it blossom and do what it does and grow into a plant. He directs the paths of the blue whale in the ocean highways. And he even directs the heart of the superpower of the day, of King Xerxes in his bedroom to fulfill God's purpose. God is active. He's active in a dreadful world. He's active in coincidence. Did you notice the coincidences in our reading? Remember, it introduced us to Esther, an orphan who'd been brought up by her cousin, a man named Mordecai. And Esther and Mordecai are Jews. And remember, Nebuchadnezzar had taken the Jews in exile to Babylon. Babylon had turned into Persia. And some of the Jews had dribbled back to Jerusalem and Judea. But Esther and Mordecai and some others had stayed in Persia. And they're probably a small minority now in a foreign land. And I guess Xerxes toyed with hundreds of women from all over the empire over those months. But one morning he woke up and he thought, she's the one. And here's the coincidence. The woman in his bed was Esther. Have a look at verse 17 with me, would you? Verse 17. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women, and she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. What a coincidence. Shall I say, what a God incident. There was one more coincidence in today's chapters. Did you notice it? Let's see from verse 21, please. During the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were hanged on a gallows. All this was recorded in the books of the annals in the presence of the king. And it seems a bit of a throwaway event. Why include it here? It's very simple, really. Two guards plot to kill King Xerxes, and Mordecai overhears it and sends a message to Esther, and she tells the king, and it's foiled. But the full importance of the incident will become very clear in the coming weeks as we carry on in Esther. It's an important coincidence. Maybe we're not surprised because we're used to reading fiction novels where coincidences happen all the time. But that's the point, isn't it? This is ordinary life, and yet God is active in the coincidences as much as in the humdrum details of ordinary everyday life. God is active. Well, what's all this got to do with us? Let's spend our last minutes trying to work that out. What has this got to do with Jesus? Obviously, Jesus was a Jew. And if the story had turned out differently, he would never have been born. The Jews would have been wiped out. Esther and Mordecai were born to save a nation. Jesus was born in that nation to save the world. Save us. Jesus was homeless while others lived to excess. Jesus was exploited before Pontius Pilate. Jesus was expelled from Jerusalem and executed on a cross. And yet God was active. The Apostle Peter said to those who killed Jesus later on, Jesus was handed over to you by God's set purpose and foreknowledge. Here today, we're a little bit like the Jews of Esther's day. Like them, we don't usually experience miracles and temples and visions and prophets and sacrifices. Our lives are mundane. But if God was active then how much more confident can Christians be that God is active in our lives today, this side of Jesus? Because one day Jesus said, go and make disciples of all nations, and surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. If we trust in Jesus, then he's with us. God is with us by his Holy Spirit. He's with us in every moment, in every breath, in every decision, in every disaster, in every frustration. God is here behind the scene. The Middle East seems to be about to explode, doesn't it? Already such a horrific scene in the Middle East. And who knows what's going to happen there in coming weeks. It's a dreadful world. And yet, we can be confident that God's active somehow. In smaller ways, we may suffer the dreadful effects of excess or expulsion or exploitation or just the rubbish frustrations of living in a fallen world. And let's be comforted that God is active. Whatever may be happening in our lives, whatever is going on with the people that we love, God is in control. The God who loves us so much, he died for us, he's active in these things. And that is the only way we can accept it. We don't understand why he doesn't do things differently. But we can trust a God who suffered the dreadfulness of the world more than any of us for good purposes. It doesn't make dreadful things any better in and of themselves. But it does mean that God can give us peace in those circumstances. Let's be comforted that God is active in this dreadful world. And let's be encouraged that he's active in our choices. Think about the decisions that Esther had to make. Lots of decisions. It's not clear if she had to choose to enter the king's harem or if she was forced, but certainly she did her best to win that contest. She took the chief eunuch's advice. Was she right? Verse 10 says she kept her nationality a secret in obedience to Mordecai. You might say that was good, but then that would have compromised her religious belief. You might say that was bad. Was that right? Verse 15 says she pleased the chief eunuch and followed his advice. Was she right to make these choices? I'm not sure. Perhaps she wasn't either. Doesn't say. But right or wrong, God was active in her choices. Maybe we have a decision to make. There are all sorts of decisions in life that come upon us, aren't there? And it's not always clear what's right and what's wrong. Should I apply for this job or that one? Should I study this subject at school or that one? Should I go out with this person or not? Should I marry this person? Should I go to this university? Loads of decisions in life. Should I go on holiday? Should I go and see someone? The doctrine of God's providence should teach us to pray as we make decisions. To pray in anticipation that the answers are already on their way, set in motion by a long chain of events, however insignificant they may seem. I remember once I had to decide what course to study at Bible college. And I just couldn't work out which course to choose. And I spoke with an old friend about it. And he simply showed me a Bible verse, James 1, verse 5, which says, "If any of you lacks wisdom, he should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to him." That's a promise for Christians who are genuinely seeking God's will. Now, humanly speaking, looking back, it's not clear whether that was, humanly speaking, a good decision or not that I took. But I asked God for wisdom. I made the best decision I could at the time in good conscience. And I trust that God overruled. I've got peace about that. And as we work through the book of Esther this month, let's learn to pray. We'll find motivation and help every week. Let's learn to pray. Learn to pray about our choices and to pray about our circumstances. Learn to pray about God's agenda even more than ours. Let's learn how to pray on our own. Learn how to pray together. How to have that confidence. If God is active in every detail, then what could be more natural than to pray always about everything? Well, in conclusion then, I love the book of Esther. I'm excited about this series, and not just because I've been studying it a lot. I love it because it's such a cracking read, but most of all because it's so real, so relevant. It could almost be today. The world is dreadful, but God is active.